Accession number 30639, Mr. Alan Davis, Reel 13. Now, since our last meeting, you've thought a bit more about some of the combat training you had, quarter attacks and that kind of thing. Looking at your logbook, obviously, has brought this back to mind. Could you remember much more about this combat training?
Well, I must admit I had forgotten about it, so it wasn't, to me at the time, I guess it was important at the time, but it's not significant enough to have made me remember it very clearly until I looked again at my logbook. But I was at Keble for quite a long time, a longer time than usual. If the normal operational training unit course was, say, let's say 3 months, I was certainly there 6 months and maybe a bit longer, because I went sick before I completed my particular course. So I went into hospital for a couple of weeks and so on. So by the time I came back, my course had moved on and I had to join a following course, a course which was following on the heels of the original one. And I must admit, I didn't like the chaps on the second course as much as I did the first course. I don't know quite why that was, a clash of personalities, I suppose, but each course, that the one I was first on and the one I was secondly on, was a course of six bodies, two of whom were ex-army. They were either seconded or had remustered into the Air Force, and they had two uniforms. Sometimes they appeared in an army uniform and sometimes in RAF uniform. Anyway, that's, by the way, the fact is that I was at Keble for at least a couple of months longer than I normally would have been. And I had forgotten that in the latter part of the course, we did quite a lot of, it seems from my logbook, quite a lot of simulated combat training. We did things which are called quarter attacks.
And what are they?
And that's where you fly parallel to the, so say, enemy or target aircraft, and then you you're slightly above, so you have an advantage of height, and as you dive down on to the target aircraft, you pick up more speed, of course, so that you overtake it, and you are taught how to do a turn in from tail, let's say, two parallel courses, a turn in to the other aircraft, and learn how to pull the nose of your aircraft along the line of flight of the target aircraft, so that you finish up with your theoretically with your gun sight some 50 or more yards ahead of the target aircraft, so that would allow for deflection. So you're doing a dummy attack on a friendly aircraft as an exercise. Well, having done that from a parallel and of course at much the same altitude, you then do exactly the same maneuver from above and below, so that you learn how to whatever angle you are attacking the aircraft from, you learn how to pull through its line of flight and finish up with your gun sight, as I say, 50 or more yards ahead of the aircraft, which would allow, as I say, for deflection. So you do that both when you're flying dual to start with, so you're shown how to do it and how to do it without particularly doing a dangerous manoeuvre for the other aircraft. It's rather important that you see him most of the time, because you don't see him when you pull the nose of the aircraft you're flying ahead, because the engine blots out the view. So you've got to know a little bit what you're doing. And I'm surprised to see how many times we did this in the last week or two, or last month or so, of my time at Keble. However, that
Now, how did your time finish? Were you assessed, or was it?
Yes, we were, but I don't, for some reason or other, it's not, doesn't appear in my logbook. I've had an assessment for every other flying unit I was at, but not one for the OTU. The summary of course unit on the in March 1946. The number of hours I flew the Harvard, the Master, the Hurricane, and the Spitfire, so on, all during those previous months. But there's no assessment, so I can only presume it was a fairly satisfactory assessment, because I left Giebel, went on leave, and whilst you're on leave, your papers catch up with you, and you get a letter posting you to your next unit.
Now, had you any opinions, not that they necessarily matter to the RAF, as to what your next posting would be? Was there a well-known squadron, or were they all pretty much... Because some people have said that 225 had an especially good reputation, but they are 225 pilots.
Yes.
You know. Well, was there, when you were in training, was there a particular squadron you wished to go to, or not?
Well, of course, all the pilots who gave us instruction were all had been members of A squadron, and that's what the tales they recounted were, you know, about their own squadron. And the only squadron I'd heard of was number 2 squadron. And I think I'd heard of 208, possibly, which was in the Middle East. But I'd never, strangely enough, never heard of 225 squadron, which is the amusing thing about it, I suppose. So I received this letter from when I was on leave.
This would be sometime in March, possibly, yes. April 46.
Yes. That's the sort of time, because I had joined. I'll explain how I got to join 225. We were sent, strangely enough, back to Heaton Park as the embarkation unit, which was very different then to as it had been previously, because I went back there as an officer, for example, and as a pilot. And we waited there just a couple of days to get to find out where the next posting was.
Now, how did it differ? Because you told us, you know, about when it first started. What was it like as an officer?
I suppose we still occupied the same Nissen huts, but theoretically there was some sort of batman service, in as much as your bed was made up for you, and you didn't have to scrounge things to sleep on and blankets to sleep in and so on. So that was all laid on for you. And instead of being about 10 or 12 to a Nissen hut, we were 4 or 6 of us to a Nissen hut. So it was relatively more room. And the messing was certainly better. Food was a lot better. And we weren't being harassed by junior NCOs, which was the big blight of the previous Heaton Park. So, strangely enough, back to Heaton Park, and then on a train to, not to Liverpool this time, but down to the south of England, and another transit camp down somewhere near Newhaven. And I think we sailed from Newhaven then over to France. And I know we got on a train in whatever, Dieppe, let's say. And we went by train from a no getting off, from Dieppe right down to Marseille. We suddenly found ourselves in the south of France. And then we embarked at Marseille onto a troop ship and went across the Mediterranean. And whereas... until now, until at this moment, I had managed to keep my head down and not get collared for any particular guard duties or anything officious like that. I got well and truly clobbered on this troop ship.
Do you know its name?
No, I can't remember its name, unfortunately.
So what were you clobbered for?
I was clobbered for... being in charge of a deck of a lower deck of airmen, so let's say 200 airmen in a all crammed down into a into the hold somewhere where they slept in bunks, and I was told I was in charge of that particular.
To the orderly officer, sort of like the orderly officer,
but permanently and not just for the day. And then worst part of it was that they all had been issued with French francs, and they all had have their cash changed into Egyptian, what were they called? Egyptian currency, anyway. I can't even remember what they were called. Piastres or something like that. And we were given a sheet of paper, and the multiplication factor by which you had to convert the French francs into this Egyptian money. And you had just given this multiplication factor, so you had to, no calculators or funny bits of equipment to do it with. It all had to be done in the head, and the ship rolled and pitched and tossed across the Mediterranean. It was very rough, so the conditions were not good for clear thinking arithmetically. And it's 200 names. Well, you had to collect all the money first and note down what money they'd handed in, and then you had a great big sack full of French francs. And then you had to hand that in to the purser or the RAF person acting as a purser's assistant, and then take the sheets of paper away, work out how many piastres or whatever the Egyptian currency was by using this multiplication factor, and then pay them. Then it had to say how many hundreds or thousands of these you wanted, and the paymaster, purser or whatever, handed it over in a great bag, and you and a couple of orderly sergeants had to summon all these 200 blokes together and pay them out in Egyptian money. And what I hadn't realised was that if you rounded down, if you rounded the figure down, you would have enough, you know, you would have a few piastres, whatever, left over. But if you didn't round down, and nobody told me anything about this, you were highly unlikely to finish up with exactly the right money. So if you rounded down, you would at least have a cumulative on 200 times. You would have a few dozen or hundred piastres left over. But anyway, we got to the last dozen of these poor airmen, seasick airmen, waiting in a line to be paid out the money they'd handed in. And of course we ran short of money just on the last one, didn't we, by about a unit of about 10 something or others. And so I had to persuade these two sergeants and myself to reach in our pockets and make up the difference, which we did. But that was a harrowing 24 hours, because I was completely unused to handling money anyway, and to handle money under those circumstances. It was very rough. It was two currencies which I knew nothing about. To have to do the conversion mentally or in the head, rather than having sort of calculator, I found, I really suffered from not keeping my head down at that particular time. Anyway, that was over. I suppose we took about 3 or 4 days to get across the Mediterranean. And we landed in Alexandria. And then we went from Alexandria to Cairo. And we had yet another transit camp, this time in tents. And we were there, I suppose, several weeks, because I know I managed to team up with some blokes who seemed to know their way around Cairo, and I very much enjoyed sightseeing in Cairo. And then inevitably the posting came through again, and I was posted then.
So when were you in Cairo? Would that be April?
Probably April, because I see it was May that I actually joined the squadron, so it would be in April. So there's no entry in my logbook then. And the only thing of significance that happened in Cairo was that, again, I failed to keep my head down, and when I was orderly officer, I had to escort a fellow officer who was under arrest for, I don't know, I did ask him what he was supposed to have done, and there was some usual business of money being short in the canteen or something, and he was responsible, and he'd got the caught for it. So he was under close arrest. That's the expression I was looking for, close arrest. And he wanted to go to church on Sunday morning, and so I had to escort him into church and out again. And I was given a loaded revolver, which, if anybody had known, I hadn't got a clue about firing it. I presumably had fired a revolver several occasions before, but again, it's not significant enough to lodged in my memory. But anyway, I do remember having to escort this poor chap to and from church.
Now, what did you think of Egypt? What were your impressions of it?
The biggest impression was the smell. I thought the smell of Egypt, or Cairo in particular, was quite unique. I can't describe it, except that you were very much aware of it when you first experienced it. I suppose it's rather similar to going to somewhere like Shanghai or Singapore nowadays. You are aware that there is a different smell in the atmosphere all the time. But that was the most significant thing, the smell of it. I quite enjoyed the food that we got in the mess, which was local food. And I do remember that during the time we were there, I don't suppose it was much of a sandstorm, but a storm did blow up, and very nearly blew the tents down, and we had sand in everywhere. And just in the 2 or 3 weeks that we were there, we had one of these sandstorms, and it was, if one had to endure that for that sort of thing happening for months and months and months and perhaps even years, it would have been a bit tiresome. Anyway, the sandstorm abated, and we managed to shake all the sand out of our belongings, and that was about that.
Now, so you were there, well, a few weeks.
Several weeks, yeah.
What happened next?
Well, then again, somebody comes along and says, pilot officer, or flying officer, I suppose I was then, flying officer Davis, your posting has come through. You're posted to 225 Squadron. No, you're posted to 225 wasn't mentioned then. You're posted to Air Headquarters, Italy. So having gone all that way around, I then had to go from Cairo back to Italy. So we were told, yes, we were, the whole batch of us, I suppose, we were told we were flying from Cairo to El Adam in North Africa, and then from El Adam over to Malta into Italy, and then we went by train from Italy up to the north of Italy, where Air Headquarters was in, I suppose, Udine, in right up in the north of Italy. So, interesting air flight from Cairo, a stopover at El Adam. El Adam, that's right. I can't remember how to spell it.
We know.
ADAM, yep, near Tobruk. Near Tobruk. Very interesting flying over, fairly lowish enough to see abandoned vehicles and so on littering the coast of North Africa. And we overnight stay at another transit camp at El Adam, and then by plane again to Malta, stop over at Malta just for a few hours to pick up, to drop passengers and pick up a few more, and then we went off to southern Italy. I can't remember where we flew to. I suppose it might have been Naples. And anyway, I was in Naples for a few days, again, waiting for transport, and it was by train from Naples right up to Udine, where the air headquarters was. So I duly reported to the air headquarters, and I was asked what operational training unit I'd done and all that sort of thing, and so they said, oh, so you're fighter reconnaissance? And I said, yes, indeed. Because I was reported there with two sergeants, sergeant pilots. And so he said, right, it's 225 squadron for you then, and some other squadron for the two sergeants. So we then, we parted company, and I had to wait in air headquarters for motor transport, and an airman or corporal or something turned up with a vehicle, which I clambered into, and we were then sent off to 225 Squadron, which at that time was at, must have been at Klagenfurt, which is strange because I remember being in northern Italy with 225. Anyway, I'd actually joined the 225 Squadron, which I'd never heard of before, at Klagenfurt.
In Austria.
In Austria. Just over the border, and I see that.
And that was May.
Then I see from my
46.
May 46. It was the 9th of May. Well, the first flight I made was the 9th of May, so it must have been a few days before that. I joined the squadron, and I see that at that time I had done 352 flying hours.
Now, what were your first impressions of 225 Squadron as a squadron? You wanted to, this is what you wanted, yes. A squadron. What did you think of them when you got there?
Well, this was the ultimate goal, wasn't it? This was what I'd really wanted to do. So I duly reported, and Klagenfurt was an ex Luftwaffe airfield, and the mess and the officers' mess was perched up on a little bit of a hill. And it was a real Austrian oblique stroke Swiss type building with timber building, with big eaves, big overhanging eaves, and most picturesque building. And with the airfield, with a single runway, down 50 feet, I suppose, a bit lower. And I duly reported. And sought out the adjutant, and he, of course, had no knowledge of us.
Who was the adjutant? Was it the well-known one?
No, it was the well-known one, Jimmy Lupton, had actually gone home. He'd gone home for demob, he being rather older and having joined up much earlier than some of the others.
So what was your reception like from this adjutant?
So the reception was, let's say, cool. There I was, on my own. I was the only pilot to report. I didn't have any buddies to either back me up or to talk to. And I found the squadron members, pilots, and Grant, the non-pilot officers, a little bit reluctant, not particularly interested in my arrival, let's say. And it took me, I can't say several days, but I think several weeks to break down this rather icy barrier. I got the impression that I was the first pilot to arrive, to join the squadron, who had not previously flown on ops. I may be wrong, but that was certainly the impression I got. And so I got the impression, perhaps wrongly, that they didn't want to talk to me very much because I was a SPROG pilot and only having 350 hours compared with their much bigger number of flying hours. I don't know how many some of them had. I never did find out. But I certainly got the feeling that for the next several weeks I was a spare part. They weren't particularly friendly. I wasn't given anything to do. So I used to turn up at the flights in the morning and not be issued, if you like, with an aeroplane, not being authorised to go to do any flying, to just look around. They worked it so they only flew in the mornings. They didn't do any flying in the afternoon, so the ground crew could get the aircraft serviced and spruced up during the afternoon, ready to fly the next morning. And so I could go down next morning and report to the flights, and again still have nothing to do, and I was very bored. And I stayed bored for, I'd say, several weeks.
What airplane did they have? They had the Spitfire, yes, but which one?
They had Spitfire 9s. And when they heard that I'd been trained on Spitfire 14s, again, that was another black mark against me, because none of them had had the chance of flying Spitfire 14s. And why did they have them in the UK, and why hadn't they got them out in Austria and Italy and so on? And I couldn't answer that, because that was just the way it happened as far as I was concerned. So anyway, I had to get used to the idea of flying a Spit 9, and which I've already told you, the propeller spun in the opposite direction to the Spit 14.
Well, so tell us a bit about, did you get a chance to fly it eventually?
Oh yes, well, I see from my logbook that the first flight I had was on May the 9th.
Now what was... Take me through the Spitfire, the Mark 9. What you thought of it?
Well, it was precisely the same layout as the 14 in the cockpit. It had a slightly different canopy, and it actually didn't have a blister canopy. It already had an ordinary canopy. The blister canopy had bulging sides so that you had better visibility. But it all had an ordinary canopy. But the controls were in exactly the same place. But instead of having this powerful Griffon engine, it had an ordinary Merlin, I've forgotten what number it was, Merlin engine. And as I said, the propeller turned the wrong way, so you had to put on opposite trim on takeoff and so on. So it had slightly different handling characteristics, and it didn't swing anything like as much as the 14 on takeoff. It did swing, but nothing by comparison. And once in the air, it was precisely the same. I mean, it felt like flying the same sort of plane, but it was noticeably less power than the 14. But by that time, by May 46, I had previously not flown anything, but certainly not a Spitfire since the March of that year, so that's March, April, May, 2 months. And 2 months is quite a long time in flying that sort of aircraft. When you were training, if you were off flying for 14 days, I noticed that you always had dual instruction, even if it was only for 10 minutes, before you went off solo again. So that they recognised that something might have happened to you in that 14 days. Well, in this case, I had 2 months of not flying, just being moved around the countryside and from country to country, mostly by train and you know, as I said, by sea and by air. Anyway, I had my first trip on May the 9th in a Spit from Klagenfurt.